Thank you so much, and it's great to be with everyone for another Brookings Twitter Spaces event on the war in Ukraine. So we're delighted to have a terrific group here to discuss the latest developments. Steve Pfeiffer is my colleague at Brookings and non-resident senior fellow. He is also the William J. Perry Fellow at the Freedom Spogli Institute at Stanford, and the author of the book, The Eagle and the Trident, History of U.S.-Ukraine Relations, which I was actually rereading over the weekend and highly recommend to everyone. Angela Stent is Professor Emerita at Georgetown University, a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings, and author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest, which I think Angela, as a book and a book title, has held up pretty well since it's been published. So I recommend that to everyone too. Jim Goldgar is a visiting fellow here at Brookings, a professor of international studies at American University, and the author of many books and articles on U.S. foreign policy, in particular on NATO and NATO enlargement. And Celia Ballon is our visiting fellow in France and European affairs here at Brookings, and Celia works on transatlantic relations, U.S.-France relations, and has been closely following the French election as well. So there's a huge amount, you know, on the table. We had the meeting between Jake Sullivan and Angie Sturt yesterday in Rome. We've had a continued sort of escalation of Russia's invasion in Ukraine, and we, I think, want to talk about over the course of this conversation maybe a few things, including whether or not there is any hope on the diplomatic track between Ukraine and Russia, what Western options might be to deter future escalation by Russia, either in Ukraine or a broadening of the conflict. But before we go to that, Steve, if I could start with you and just get your sense really of where things are for Ukraine at the moment with the Zelensky government. How are they sort of thinking about their situation, you know, and position, and how has that changed maybe in the past week or so? Steve, over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. No, I think both President Zelensky, his government, but also the Rada, Ukraine's parliament, they continue to defiantly work in Kyiv. And they're showing the determination that you've seen over the last 2.5 weeks by the Ukrainians to resist the Russian attack. I think for many Ukrainians, this is almost an existential threat in that they see losing, meaning an end to Ukrainian democracy, and particularly for younger people, meaning an end to the vision of Ukraine's future as a normal European state. You have seen over the past week or so a couple of indications, I think, from President Zelensky of a readiness to be flexible. A couple times he's raised the question of neutrality and perhaps even suggested that Ukraine might alter its position with regards to NATO membership. But I don't think he's seen anything serious back in Moscow unless something is taking place in these discussions between Ukrainians and Russians that has not yet been disclosed. There also, though, is a sense of frustration, which is very clear in Kyiv, that they are fighting a war that they believe is not just against Ukraine, but perhaps is more broadly against Europe. They feel that they are fighting it alone. While they appreciate the arms supplies from the West, they do want to see something more. And they continue, for example, to repeat a request for a no-fly zone, which NATO has pretty much ruled out.
Steve, if I could just follow up maybe on one bit of that. So President Zelensky today, I think, made a comment, you know, on NATO and that Ukraine will not be joining NATO just as a reality. As you mentioned, there's been some movement a little bit on the neutrality question. Could you talk to us a little bit about maybe your interpretation of how we got to this and also, you know, whether or not it's significant? Obviously, Russia's aims are much bigger than that, and the war has been sort of raging with, you know, catastrophic consequences in terms of civilian casualties and the like. So, you know, can't go back maybe to the pre-war situation of negotiations. But what do you think his sort of strategic thinking is on this issue?
I guess I'd make two observations. First of all, when he became president back in 2019, it appeared that President Zelensky was really ambivalent about Ukraine's relationship with NATO. Over the past couple of years, I think his views has hardened as he's seen that Russia was really not prepared to negotiate seriously in terms of trying to find a solution to the conflict in Donbas. But I think now it's significant that he's being prepared to put on the table that, you know, Ukraine, or at least he might favor Ukraine accepting something other than NATO membership or NATO as a long-term goal, some kind of neutrality. So I do think that that is an evolution in his thinking over the past 10 days. However, having said that, although the Russians in the run-up to this war tried to frame their dispute primarily as a dispute between Russia and NATO, I don't think that bears out. This is much more about Ukraine's relationship with NATO. And I would just note that back in 2013, Russia had a neutral Ukraine. The Ukrainian parliament had passed a law in 2010 on Ukraine's non-bloc status, but the Russians put heavy pressure on then-President Yanukovych, who also was not interested in joining NATO, but heavy pressure on him not to sign an association agreement with the European Union. And then when Yanukovych succumbed to that pressure, that of course triggered the Maidan Revolution. So I believe this conflict is way beyond just NATO. It's about Russia wanting to have a significant say, not only in Ukrainian foreign policy, but also in Ukrainian domestic policy.
Thanks, Steve. Angela, if I could turn to you, Angela, in terms of the view from Moscow, you know, Vladimir Putin's now 3 weeks into this war that obviously has not gone as he intended. He has responded, I guess, as many people would have expected after those initial setbacks by increasing the level of violence and being more indiscriminate about the targeting of civilians. But how do you think he sort of sees the strategic picture right now? Does he worry, you know, about the possibility of NATO intervention, even though that has been ruled out? Is he focused on, you know, on winning the war in an ugly way? Or is there any chance of a diplomatic settlement? Could you talk us through a little bit, you know, given all of the work you've done on Vladimir Putin and his worldview, how this might look to him in his relative isolation?
Thank you, Tom. Well, first of all, you know, we do have to ask how accurate is the information he's getting. He apparently thought or was told by the people who are advising him that this operation would take about 72 hours, that Russian troops would march in, they would take Kiev shortly, the Ukrainians would welcome them as liberators, and they could effect regime change with a pro-Russian government that would eschew ties with the European Union, ties with NATO. That obviously didn't happen. And I suppose it's dawned on him and his closest advisors in these past 2.5 weeks that, you know, there's no easy capture of Kiev, that Ukrainians are resisting, as Steve Pfeiffer has said, quite valiantly, and that NATO was, in fact, being very restrained. Because President Biden and other and Secretary General Stoltenberg have said, we are not going to get directly involved in this. So one has to assume, if you look at what's happening, that Russia's war aims have changed, that the Kremlin realizes that probably regime change isn't on the cards, because if they were to put in power a puppet government, they'd have to occupy Ukraine. No puppet government could last when Russian troops withdrew. They're still, of course, trying to take Kiev. It's not clear that they will or that they think that they will. But on the other hand, you know, they have been successful in terms of the southeastern part of Ukraine. One wonders whether they're going to be moving on Odessa at some point in the near future. They've leveled Mariupol. You've all seen the terrible scenes of destruction, the rubble in that city, the humanitarian catastrophe there. But they have taken territory and they have, you know, destroyed already a lot of Ukraine's industrial base. So, you know, if they wanted to weaken Ukraine, they've clearly done that. If they wanted to endear themselves to the Ukrainians, they've done the exact opposite. I mean, everything that Putin and the Kremlin have done in the past year is to further alienate Ukrainians and to create a stronger sense of Ukrainian national identity. So now the question is, what might the Russians be willing to discuss with the Ukrainians? Their maximal demands have always been that Ukraine should say it never wants to join NATO. I believe they would also want Ukraine to say that it has no interest in joining the European Union. As we know, neither of these organizations has membership offers out anyway, but the Russians would want those guarantees. Then Putin has said explicitly he wants to demilitarize Ukraine, and the Russians, you know, they're methodically trying to do that. They've clearly, the Ukrainian armed forces, again, are putting up a valiant fight, but they have been weakened by all of this. They've lost casualties. We don't know what the numbers are. So that's certainly been, and I would say remains, another Russian goal. Then they wanted to, quote unquote, denazify Ukraine. I mean, and we still hear that from Foreign Minister Lavrov, whatever that means. But I think that was really meant to refer to Zelensky himself, the democratically elected Jewish president of a state that was said to be Nazi. But I think some of that, that rhetoric has gone away now. Would Russia be willing to, and they want, of course, Ukraine to recognize the independence of the two people's republics in the Donbas. How much of that would Ukraine be willing to do? We have heard from President Zelensky, as Steve Pfeiffer has said, that he would be willing to say that, Ukraine does not aspire to join NATO, that NATO membership is off the cards. How much of the other demands he would be willing to meet, we don't know. That this process is going on for a long time. I do think that the Russians might have anticipated that there could have been more of a NATO involvement in this conflict. It hasn't happened yet. Everyone has been very disciplined. And there are questions about why they haven't used more of their air power and some of their other military power. And that might be because they're still thinking that they could get involved in a conflict with NATO. But the war really isn't going the way that they thought it would go. And they've only had partial success. And I suppose for Putin, if there is to be a negotiated settlement, it obviously has to be one in which he can declare victory. And so I think we're some way away from that yet. At least one hopes that there'll be a ceasefire, at least for a period of time, and so that to create a humanitarian corridor, so that some of the disaster that we see happening there in terms of human life, that situation could improve.
Angela, just as a quick follow-up, and then we'll turn to Jim, but how do you think Putin thinks about, massive escalation? Obviously, he's escalated already, but in terms of what people talk about, whether it's the use of chemical weapons, of other WMD, or of broadening out the conflict, these are steps that would, at least prompt a debate internationally about how to respond. Do you think he would, what do you think his calculations are in terms of thinking about those options?
I think certainly the Kremlin wants us to believe that there could be the use of chemical weapons or even of, a tactical nuclear weapon, because Putin himself has hinted at that, although he hasn't been explicit. So far as we can see, the Russians haven't done that. On the other hand, if you look at the playbook that the military playbook, say, in a place like Syria, and you see similar things happening in Ukraine, in terms of just indiscriminately killing civilians, raising or trying to raise whole cities, you wonder whether the use of chemical weapons might be part of that. So I think everyone is aware that that could happen. And I think that's probably also one of the reasons for the relative restraint of the NATO allies, is not to do anything to provoke that. But you cannot rule it out.
Thank you. Thanks, Angela. Jim, if we could turn over to you. I mean, you've been very focused on the NATO piece of it. Obviously, there was a lot of unity early on and still, particularly on the sanctions piece. But, the people are sort of wondering what's left in the locker in terms of deterring, future escalation by Russia. Could you talk to us a little bit about your thinking on that and maybe what NATO's role in this is likely to be going forward?
Well, thanks, Tom. I mean, as you say, NATO has been unified. And NATO has also been very clear that NATO troops would not be stationed on Ukraine's territory, and that NATO is going to avoid being directly in a war with Russia. I think the pressure is going to continue to grow. So we've seen the NATO unity, we've seen the supplies, you know, extraordinary effort to supply Ukraine with the Javelins and the Stingers and all the other equipment. And, you know, I think this is all incredibly important and an incredible sign that NATO wants to do what it can to help Ukraine defend itself, while at the same time not creating a situation in which there is a broader war between NATO and Russia. The Secretary General announced that he's convening an extraordinary summit at NATO on March 24th. And so, you know, we'll see what comes out of that. I think if Putin continues to engage in this kind of horrific bombing of civilians, which I expect to see, I mean, we've seen him do it in Aleppo, and we've seen him do it in Grozny before that. So it's clear that he doesn't care about killing civilians. And so I think we can expect that to continue. And if it does, I think there'll just be increasing pressure on NATO to do more. But at this point, if the goal is to send equipment to help Ukrainians defend themselves without having NATO state member states have troops that are directly engaging with Russian forces, there are going to be limits to what NATO can do. It's also important to note, I mean, NATO, US, and its allies have been very clear about defending every inch of NATO territory should Putin decide to escalate this war beyond Ukraine. And the reassurance of countries like Poland and the Baltics that NATO will be there to defend them is extremely important for NATO to do. Question is whether something occurs that's sort of less than clear what it is that does involve NATO territory, and then how NATO would respond. I mean, I think there are a lot of situations that could be quite murky that would put NATO in a very difficult position in terms of standing up for itself, defending a member state, supporting Ukraine, but not getting into a war with Russia.
Thanks, Jim. And just as a follow-up, what do you, I mean, what would your answer be to what are those, you know, what are those options that NATO still has short of, you know, direct intervention to either deter or after the fact to sort of respond to dramatic escalations by Russia? Like what, I mean, the sanctions, you know, I guess there's still some, you know, on the table, but for the most part, they've been, you know, used already. So as you sort of look at, you know, the question of chemical weapons, for instance, or right, our other challenges, you know, what are some of the options NATO leaders have to say, if you do that, then they would do this?
Yeah, just first on the issue of sort of in terms of what's being done now, and as you point out, the sanctions, I mean, the sanctions are extremely tough. And, you know, the question is whether or not if they will have enough bite, you know, in the coming weeks to make a difference. You know, I don't think we know yet how much of a difference they could make in terms of Putin's calculations, in terms of the effect on the Russian people, on the effect on those around Putin. And of course, you know, the kinds of military equipment that's being sent to Ukraine, NATO could, you know, continue to do that and do more and, you know, provide Ukraine with as much as it can. I mean, it's tricky on this question of, you know, whether Putin would use, chemical weapons in this instance, whether he would go to this step, to in some way use tactical nuclear weapons, whether that means, you know, it was single detonation, whether or not, you know, people talk about a demonstration effect where he do some kind of high altitude detonation to show that he's really serious about, you know, his willingness to use them. I mean, I don't anticipate NATO setting any kind of red lines in advance. I mean, we saw that, you know, in Syria with President Obama in the setting of a red line. And so, I mean, it does put NATO in a very tricky situation because I don't think they're going to want to, you commit to something ahead of time in terms of response. But on the other hand, if you're going to deter the youth, you want to make sure that he has a pretty clear idea that you would, in fact, have a sufficiently strong response to make him think that he shouldn't do it in the first place. I mean, it's, you know, these are classic issues of deterrence that are being raised here. And I think that these remain difficult conversations for NATO to have. And presumably that's a main topic of conversation at the upcoming NATO summit.
Thanks, Jim. Celia, could you talk to us a little bit about how the war is seen in Europe? I mean, prior to the invasion, European leaders, I think, were at one with the U.S. and with other, you know, with Ukraine in terms of being concerned about Russian aggression. But there was maybe generally more of a surprise that this might be possible, and maybe more of an expectation that it might be somewhat limited. Since then, of course, it hasn't been very limited at all, and Europe has responded very assertively with, you know, very tough sanctions, a very unified approach. You know, has there been something of a, has it come as something of a shock? And what do you think those long-term repercussions are, you know, of the war on the European body politic as a whole?
Well, thanks, Tom. Yes, we had several occasions to discuss this prior to the invasion, of course, regarding the differences of mood between Europe and the US, or at least in policy circles, the type of discussion we were having. European leaders and the public was, of course, aware of the troop buildup. But I believe for quite a while, especially Western Europeans still sort of held on to the belief that this was probably brinksmanship on part of Putin, that he was just trying to put extreme pressure on Ukraine to get get something out of it. But then suddenly when the invasion occurred, I think even though some had anticipated a limited offensive, when the invasion occurred and it soon appeared to be extremely violent, extremely large with maximum goals, I think there was an utter shock in Europe. This shock continues to this day, but it has been accompanied with also determination to make it count, to decide that this time was different. This time was not Crimea. This time was not even the war in Georgia, because it appeared not only to be obviously intolerable for people under threat, but also because it deals directly with Europe's security at large. It's become instant, an existential threat for Europe. And I think what we've seen over the next few weeks is overwhelming unity coming out of Europe, not only at the EU level, with European leaders all coming together, including those that were viewed as more closer to Russia, an overwhelming unity in answering forcefully with very strong sanctions, unprecedented. You have a fourth package of sanctions that just got voted. Now, this time it's on steel imports or on luxury good exports to Russia. But also the idea that this unity of purpose, this unity of action should continue not only during the moment of the conflict, but go forward to in the future in achieving a greater sovereignty for Europe, greater independence from this toxic relationship with Russia. This has really been the case. However, I'm also mindful that what we are seeing in Europe is also quite of an emotional difference from what we can observe in the US. People who travel back and forth report that, you know, war feel much closer to home in Europe, obviously, not only because it's extremely close to home for Poland. Russia just attacked a military base in Ukraine 2 days ago that was only 11 miles from the Polish borders, but also because of the almost 3 million wave of refugees that is now arriving in Europe and that European countries will have to take care of. But also because there are scenes that are now happening on European territory that are unbearable to obviously observe, and even more given the proximity to home, including, you know, the destructions of private residential area homes, people in basements, all the images that come out from the Ukraine war zone, the terrible situation of Mariupol residents, also the flight of Jewish communities, for example, in sort of flashbacks to the worst moments of European history. For all of these reasons, I believe we are still in a moment of high emotions that are represented by protests, by unity. But I would point out just one little caveat there is that obviously, because it's so emotional, you will start to see sort of a polarizing debate on what to do next. Because at the heart of the emotion, the emotion is fear. And when you have fear, you start polarizing between those who are willing to tackle the threat and those who maybe want to do anything possible to avoid the danger, that the danger would get closer to home. And so you are starting to have constituency that are more either closest to pacifist constituencies or closer to nationalist far-right constituencies that are starting to sow doubts that, you know, Europe should really get involved, that European countries should do more, that are very wary about seeing NATO get involved, or are even for some extreme right groups doubting that, you know, these waves of refugees should be really taken in. So I think what we should look out for is the effect on public opinion long term and how European countries can avoid starting, you know, to have entrenched camp or polarizing debates over the war in Ukraine and remain united in face of the threat.
Thanks, Celia. Just a quick follow-up for you on the visit today of the Polish, Czech, and Slovenian prime ministers to Ukraine. There are some reports that, you know, this wasn't fully coordinated inside the EU. And I'm just wondering what's your sort of analysis both of that and whether or not there are, you know, potential these still differences of view on how to respond between Eastern Central European countries on the one hand and Western European countries on the other, and maybe, you know, what and the leader you study the most on this, Emmanuel Macron, how do you think he is, you know, trying to address that and keep sort of Europe, you know, on a single path here?
So just a quick take on this, because this is developing and I don't have all the elements, obviously, on this. What I can what I heard about it is that there was a surprise over this initiative and quite a few European leaders being unhappy to have known about it just at the moment when it happened or closely before it. This was not a coordinated decision to have these three prime ministers going into Kyiv to visit Zelensky. At the same time, it has provoked two types of reaction. Really, one type that is applauding the sort of daring move from these prime ministers, people saying that it's one way to just dare to look Putin in the eye and ask him whether he's really willing to go as far as to as to take a risk over this visit, or and also to put a new legitimacy into Kyiv's authorities and their president, demonstrating really a sense of solidarity. So quite a few people are out there applauding, and others are sort of regretting the risk being taken, that it could be perceived as an involuntary provocation to the belligerent. In any case, what's going to be important then is to really determine what comes out of it. For the moment, as much I would say from a French perspective, you know, the French have kept alive the idea that even if this does not bear any fruit, the French president and the German chancellor should continue to talk to Vladimir Putin. So they're doing their own initiative on the diplomatic front. So it would be misplaced on their part to sort of criticize the Polish, Czech and Slovenian initiative now for doing also their own form of reassurance. But what I can say on the Macron diplomatic front is that the thinking behind it of these repeated phone calls is that, you know, first there's the recognition that Putin is isolated and closed up in his own logic, and so in some ways it's not that bad that someone would tell him what it is, even if it doesn't bear any fruit. But secondly, the French seem to believe that it's important to keep a channel open for even, it's not exactly a channel for discussion, but a potential channel for negotiations if down the line, at some point, the calculation change for Putin, and at some point he's ready to take any of these negotiation route, at least you will have a channel that is open. So it's a very modest sort of ambition at the moment, but that could prove important down the line.
Thanks, Celia. That's terrific. Steve, if I could go back to you, and we have a question from the audience that I think is very interesting. It's could the panelists, could you address Ukraine and Zelensky's incentives to push for escalation by the U.S., given the existential threat to Ukraine? Does it make sense from Zelensky's perspective to push for measures like the no-fly zone and the MiGs? And I guess this gets to a larger question that when you look at how Zelensky's been operating, you know, he's obviously been very impressive and really resonated internally and externally, but he's also been, you know, consistently calling for much greater levels of intervention, including sort of direct intervention by NATO forces. Could you tell us a little bit about why you think he's doing that? And especially since, you know, NATO leaders have been pretty clear that they don't want to do that, and how how he might sort of think about it, and then what your own analysis is of whether or not that's the right approach or not.
No, I think it's very understandable for President Zelensky and for other senior Ukrainians to be asking the West to do more. I mean, certainly if I was in their situation, I would be making the same requests. But I also think that the reluctance so far on the part of NATO is understandable. And I actually wonder whether if NATO did get involved, say NATO sent military forces in to defend Ukraine, how would that affect the way that Vladimir Putin looks at this? I mean, right now, Putin still has a way out in that he always has the option of sort of publicly scaling down his objectives to demilitarization. He can say, I've destroyed a significant part of the Ukrainian army, and I can withdraw and go home. He can claim victory. But I wonder if NATO comes in, that may well feed into this fantasy, paranoid fear that Putin has had for years now that, you know, the United States, NATO want to use Ukraine and unite against him. And I do wonder, well, I tend to discount the worries about, for example, Russian use of tactical nuclear weapons. But if NATO comes in, does Putin then see this fight as truly existential for him? And then does that lead him to do things like use tactical nuclear weapons when Ukraine would be the battlefield. So I think there is some risk to Ukraine, although I can understand why many Ukrainians still would like to see the United States and NATO in there fighting on their behalf.
Thank you, Steve. Angela, I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I have a different question for you, if that's okay, and that's on the China piece of this. Over the weekend, multiple media outlets reported, based on sources, I think, from the U.S. government, that Russia had made a request to China for assistance. Yesterday, it was clarified that I think there was 5 specific requests made. Obviously, before the invasion, we had the joint statement. Since then, we've maybe had a little bit more, a tiny bit of ambiguity in terms of what certain Chinese officials said. Could you maybe talk to us a little bit about what Putin is up to here and what he wants from China? And, does he sort of expect, or is he sort of counting on Chinese assistance over, in the weeks and maybe even months ahead?
Sorry about that. So first of all, we have to remember that Putin would not have undertaken this war had he not been assured of Chinese support. He was in Beijing on the 4th of February. The Chinese and Russians issued this very long declaration of their partnership. The Chinese reinforced all of the Russian accusations about NATO threatening Russia, about Russia having a right to security and indivisible security, and the Russians endorsed some of the Chinese positions, obviously, on Taiwan and some other issues. And they both claimed that they were as democratic as so-called democracies. It was just in a different way. We also know that the attack on Ukraine began 2 days after the end of the Olympics. I mean, the Paralympics were still going on, but the Olympics were over. And we presume that there must have been some coordination there, given that the Chinese didn't want a repeat of what happened in 2008, when the Russo-Georgia War began as the Beijing Summer Olympics were beginning. So the support is there. It's not clear, I don't think any of us know, at least from public information, whether the Chinese understood that this was going to be a full-scale invasion or whether they thought it was going to be more limited to an operation in the Donbas. But anyway, since it's occurred, we've had, on the one hand, the Chinese reiterating that they believe in territorial integrity and the sovereignty of all countries, and the foreign minister at least saying that applied to Ukraine too. And they've reiterated, the Chinese, that they have a good relationship with Ukraine, which of course is part of the Belt and Road. So, but I think all of that, the Russians understand. I think if these reports are correct, then I think Russia would like China to render military assistance to Russia in this conflict. But I think from Russia's point of view, and this is something which, again, we only know some things about that, the Russians, want to find out, what are the Chinese going to do about all these massive sanctions that have been imposed on Russia? Are they, because of their own political and economic, particularly interests in Europe and the United States, are they going to go along with some of these sanctions for fear of not jeopardizing their own economic development? Or are they going to, on the other hand, are they going to help bail Russia out from some of these sanctions, particularly on the financial side, given the sanctions on Russia's central bank and on the SWIFT payment system and things like that? So I think we have to wait and see what happens there. But the indications until now, again, if you look at the UN votes and everything, is that China is backing Russia up in this conflict, even though one assumes that the Chinese don't necessarily welcome the specter that we've seen of all the destruction, the carnage, the humanitarian catastrophe in Ukraine. They haven't given any indications that they are trying to rein Russia in. Of course, we did have Jake Sullivan, our national security advisor, meeting with his Chinese counterpart. They, I think, met for 7 hours. And we know that they discussed all of these issues. We clearly don't know what the outcome of those discussions was. So I think the Chinese I think, and as time goes on, the Chinese will face these contradictory pressures on their own decision making. And they may not be willing to give Russia everything that Russia would want. But I think that Putin understands that for now, he can depend on the Chinese to support Russia through this war, and that irrespective of whether Chinese supplies military weapons, I mean, if China were to supply weapons that are used in this war, then in a sense, they do become party to the conflict. And so you have to think about what the implications of that are. But I think at a minimum, Putin wants to be able to still continue to count on Xi Jinping's support for this war.
Thanks, Angela. Jim, sort of following up on that a bit, you know, to many people, the outbreak of the Russian invasion and the joint statement with China and the support China's given since, at least some backing, including the UN on this Russian disinformation on bioweapon labs in Ukraine, that looks a lot like democracy versus autocracies. But at the same time, you know, we have the governments of India and of Brazil, maybe some others, you know, providing some support or at least not sort of coming out against Putin on this issue. So what do you think the broader sort of geopolitical lesson, you know, is from this? What are the dividing lines, you know, in the world in terms of how countries look at the invasion?
Well, I suppose that a big lesson is countries follow what they perceive to be their own interests. You know, in the India case, for example, I mean, you have Russia being a major supplier of India with military equipment. And, you know, India's main focus is on China as well, of course, as on Pakistan. And so, you know, the last thing they wanted was to have to, you know, get involved in this. And India is an important partner in the Indo-Pacific Quad, the Quad of India, Australia, Japan, the United States. I think the United States remains eager to have strong Indian support for the role of the Quad and, in a sense, will sort of try to isolate these issues from one another. I mean, President Biden has made clear coming into office that the democracy versus autocracy frame was very important to him. And of course, ensuring the survival of democracy in the United States is the number one priority, but also, you know, being able to strengthen democracy globally. And he hosted his summit for democracy in December. I think a big interesting question, just following on Angela's remarks, is sort of to what extent did Putin and Xi believe their own propaganda that the West was in decline and, you know, the West had grown soft and that, you know, couldn't really do very much anymore. I mean, I assume Xi Jinping can't be too happy at the fact that the West, in fact, seemed capable of doing quite a bit and that NATO is unified and NATO has the capacity to act. And of course, those two leaders weren't the only ones who were believing in that propaganda. There were plenty of people in the West who were believing that the West was in decline. So I think that this war is showing that the West is capable of standing up for what it perceives as its interests and its values and the importance of an international order in which countries like Russia can't simply send their militaries across the border in an unprovoked attack against a weaker neighbor. And of course, the UN vote with 141 countries voting in favor of the resolution condemning the invasion of Ukraine and only five countries opposing it, I think was an important sign that there are a lot of countries in the world that feel the same way. So I think that, you know, there is a lot to this idea of you know, the difference between democracy and autocracy. I mean, I don't want to live in an authoritarian state. It's very important to me that the United States remains a democracy and that we continue to work with our democratic partners. Obviously, there are issues in the world that can't be addressed without some cooperation across these divides. Climate change can't be addressed. Nuclear proliferation. Getting to the Iran nuclear deal requires cooperation across these divisions. But I think you know that the West has surprised a lot of people in its ability to be as united as it's been in the face of this unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. And I think that that's a potentially a very hopeful sign for the future in terms of the West's ability to deal with countries like Russia and China that may have believed that the West wouldn't stand up.
Thank you, Jim. Celia, on this China question, you know, Europeans have moved closer to the U.S. position to some extent on China since COVID in 2020. But, you know, there's still, you know, a hesitancy about a concern that this could become a new Cold War, a worry, about a lack of engagement. What's the mood in Europe? What's your sense of how governments are looking at this in terms of the close cooperation between China and Russia? How worried are they about this possibility of military assistance being provided? And do you get the sense that there's sort of a, you know, that would result in a major change in the European outlook toward China?
That's a tough question, Tom, because I don't think on either side of the Atlantic we are settled on the idea of whether China has fully embraced Russia's narrative or is fully in agreement on Russia or supporting Russia in this Ukraine endeavor. And the signaling coming out of both the Russia-China declaration in February and more recently the abstentions of China, the UN or silence and some of the sort of Chinese state media coming out mostly in their majority, if I understand correctly, mostly in support of the Russian narrative, tend to have us think that you can have a sort of a Chinese-Russia alliance against the Western NATO narrative. But other observers point out that China is not at ease with the situation. And therefore, I think Europeans, as much as Americans, are observing right now. And they are absolutely determined that they're not going to start fighting on all fronts or, that they might, if they truly want to isolate Russia on the world stage, they might want to see cooperation from China on sanctions or at least not have China voluntarily compensate for the effects of the sanctions and therefore allowing Russia to retain its full economic power, and therefore diminishing the sort of punishing effect that the sanctions are trying to implement. At the same time, I don't think there's if we take the long term view, the sort of post conflict view, if we hope that at some point Russia takes an off ramp and find some way towards negotiations in order for this war to stop, there's going to be a need to engage Russia, including Putin's Russia. And there's, you know, Russia cannot be isolated like Iran or like North Korea. And even for these countries, they always seek the support of others. And maybe in that case, the fact that Russia and China have this relationship will actually allow for some flexibility in the system. I'm thinking in particular that there are other global challenges for which inevitably, you know, Russia's cooperation or at least something short of an outright hostility will be needed out of Russia, for example, on fighting climate change or maybe on other types of global challenges where a minimal interaction will be needed. And in that case, you know, there's no interest in really having in trying to take to really polarize the world, whether it's against Russia or against China or against both. I think the understanding of Europeans at this stage is that they are going to focus first, of course, on security and stability so that the war stops and that the conflict stops. That's the first priority. Second, that Europe will seek its own sovereignty and its own independence to be stronger, to avoid having these toxic relationship that makes it weaker but stands stronger on its own feet. And then long term, be able to engage even with these massive powers that are so hostile in the world, but that need to be engaged on an array of global challenges. That's just a long-term strategy that we cannot avoid and that are going to continue to be in the background, which is why I think the democracies versus autocracies sort of narrative only work with the limit that there needs to be some form of cooperation with the major autocracies out there, including on COVID, including on climate change and other global challenges.
Thanks, Celia. Thank you, Steve. If I could come back to you and just really looking at the immediate, sort of going from the long-term implications to the immediate picture, what is it that Ukraine needs, do you think, in the coming weeks? And what's your, I know you touched on this at the beginning, but what's your sense of the military sort of situation and what is it within the existing constraints that the outside world can do to help Ukraine in the near term?
Yeah, no, I think the military situation continues to evolve. It looks like the Russians are maneuvering forces to try to encircle Kyiv, the capital, which I believe is still their top target. But there's a question that has arisen, which is whether the Russians have sufficient forces, in fact, to completely encircle Kyiv. We were talking earlier about the prospect of Russian use of chemical weapons. I guess I see that less likely. What I fear, though, is more indiscriminate use of conventional weapons, just artillery. Does frustration in the Kremlin reach the point where they start doing to cities like Kyiv and Kharkiv and Mariupol what the Russian military did to Grozny back during the Russian Chechen War? And that could get very, very ugly very quickly. So the sorts of things I think that the Ukrainians could use now would be counter-battery radars, which we have provided to the Ukrainians in the past, which would allow them to track where fire was coming from and allow them to effectively return fire at Russian artillery. I think that could be useful. And again, that's equipment that the Ukrainians have been using now for several years, so they should be familiar with it. I think as many anti-armor weapons as is possible, the Ukrainians use those very effectively. Including when the Russian front line bypasses them, the Ukrainians are using them to attack supply convoys, which is probably a big reason why the Russian offensive is not playing out as quickly as the Russians might like. Certainly more anti-air capability would be useful to the Ukrainians. Their air defense seems to be working surprisingly well against the Russians, but to the extent that we can augment that, we can give the Ukrainians greater capabilities to defend their own airspace. So I think those are the sorts of things that should be provided. And right now, there's an opportunity, but the United States and NATO should be really flooding Ukraine with these kinds of weapon systems that the Ukrainians know how to use now so that they can continue the job of defending themselves.
Thanks, Steve. Angela, we just have a few minutes left. I guess one question that I think is super important that everyone's interested in, but we haven't had a chance to talk about yet, is Putin's domestic situation. You know, how much pressure he feels he's under because of these sanctions, whether or not his domestic power position is consolidated or safe from his perspective. How vulnerable do you think he is? And we've seen obviously pretty dramatic press reports of arrests on in Moscow of protesters, and protester yesterday in the media. How is he looking at all of that, and how worried do you think he is?
Well, we know from an intercepted phone call that somehow got on the internet, just part of it, who knows who leaked it. There's a conversation, or a part of a conversation, between President Putin and his Prime Minister Mishustin. And certainly he understands how bad the economic situation is. And his poor Prime Minister is trying to, you know, find ways and argue ways that they can try and save the economy. So I think I don't believe that Putin thought before the war began that there would be such Western unity on such tough sanctions. And I'm not saying it would have deterred him if he would have known that, but I'm sure that he's surprised that the Europeans have gone along with so many of these sanctions, you know, Germany being the country that did the most remarkable about face on 50 years of Ostpolitik in terms of what it's the sanctions it was willing to impose on Russia and the weapons supplies to Ukraine. So he's definitely concerned about that. You know, as far as we know, his domestic position is still pretty strong. You know, he's surrounded by people, a small group of people who've been advising him on this war and who I think feed into all of the grievances that he has, his suspicions about the West, his concerns. There have been protests. There have been thousands of people arrested, but these tend to be mainly urban, educated people. A number of these people have left. More of them have been jailed. The woman yesterday who appeared on the main evening news with a banner saying "No war and you're being fed lies," she was apparently fined today, and that was it. I think the larger question is, you know, as more body bags come back, how are parents, spouses, siblings of the dead men going to react to all of this? But I think we do have to remember that most Russians are still living in a complete information bubble. If they only have access to state-run media, they are being told a completely different story about what's happening in Ukraine. It was provoked by Ukraine. There haven't been many casualties. So they, you know, there's going to be a cognitive dissonance there, but I think we'll have to wait and see. And then I think we have to wait and see how these economic sanctions hit average Russians. You know, they're having trouble getting money out of the ATMs. Again, the kind of more urban elites can't use their credit cards anymore. But of course, you know, a large number of Russians live in the provinces and in rural areas, and they don't have credit cards like that. So I think we shouldn't be too quick to assume that there's going to be a real stirring of unrest in Russia that's somehow going to lead to some kind of regime change. I don't think we're there yet. But I do think, you know, the longer the sanctions last, the more the average person will feel them. And I think one of the sanctions that will be particularly impactful but take a long time to work are, in fact, the export controls on semiconductors, on other essential elements for Russia's own industrial economy. And when those don't come anymore, Russia will fall further and further behind in terms of its economic development. Plus, at the moment, you've only seen a U.S. Boycott, or, you know, we're not buying Russian oil or gas anymore. But it remains to be seen what happens with Europe as time goes on and depending on how this war goes on. So for now, you know, the Kremlin can deal with this, and we'll have to wait and see what happens in the future.
Angela, thank you so much. Thank you all. We're just about out of time. But we will look forward to our next Twitter Spaces, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. But thank you to our four speakers and to all of you for joining.